Well, hello there, and welcome along to this week's edition of The Front Page. I'm your host, Maddie Playle, for today's show, and I'm joined by Chris Cook and Matt Rennie as the baton has officially been passed from the flat season to the jump season. We're going to discuss all things Champions Day. It was a bonkers few hours of sporting action. We're also going to discuss some Cheltenham changes that have been potentially put on the table this week. We'll get the panel's views on those. Finally, betting shop closure. Several firms have announced that their shops are likely to be taken off the high street. Perhaps they already are, being the impending budget sure to have a massive impact and potential job losses on the cards there. We'll get straight stuck in with today's show. Walking into the office today, Chris and I are here, and the weather very much jump weather now. But it is our opportunity to look back on Champions Day, which was just incredible, really, from start to finish. Had me holding my breath the whole way. I guess the main talking point to start with, gents, is the fact that we had history rewritten in the Champions Sprint with powerful Gloria 200-1 shot winning for Richard Fahey, and that man Jamie Spencer back on the straight track. And if that wasn't enough, we had a 100-1 winner of the QE2 in Cicero's Gift for a very emotional Jason Watson and Charlie Hills. Now, Champions Day, we're used to there being slightly bizarre results, usually due to soft ground, but that wasn't the case this year. Good ground. Why these crazy results then, Chris? Is it just that it's the end of the season? Was there a track bias? What's your take on it?
End of the season has got to be a really big factor, doesn't it? You take a horse like Delacroix. I think he had his first run at the end of March. And you know, he's only a three-year-old as well. He's not one of these super robust older horses. So some of these horses, they're just bound to be feeling like this is one run too many, and you never really quite know if that's going to affect the horse until you run them and find out. There were other issues at play, and of course it's hard to separate out these various factors. I think there was a draw bias. If you look at the QE2 in particular, it really looked like the low numbers on the far side were favoured. But this has sort of been coming for Champions Day. And I find it hard to say exactly why this fixture should be this way. Like the first seven times we had Champions Day at Ascot from 2011 onwards, you know, a fairly standard set of results, even if there was some cut in the ground. You could think that if you were one of those people who thought this is a day that should be recognizing, you know, proper champions and not throwing up weird results that need explaining, you'd have been happy with the first seven editions of Champions Day, I think, and the biggest shock was Royal Diamond 20-1. Then the next seven, taking us up to last year, we had two winners at 40-1, two at 33s, a 28-1 winner and a 22-1 winner. And then culminating in what we had on Saturday, which was, I think, two of the five most surprising winners in the history of British Group 1 races going back to 1971. So yeah, time of the year is a big factor, but there's some other sort of weirdness involved, and I wish I could get my head around it. I love trying to back surprising winners at big prices, but there still has to be some sort of logical reason why this horse in particular, right? And even now that those horses are past the post, Powerful Glory and Cicero's Gift, I'm still sort of slightly baffled as to how it happened. I don't know if you guys had any more luck.
Absolutely. I had no luck. I had one bet, and that was on Fox Legacy in the Champions Stakes, and I was quite happy to just watch. And maybe that colours my view slightly, but there was some complaints of people saying, you know, it ruins the day, it's a joke and all the rest of it. And I personally love it when you have that just bonkersness that just reminds us that racing is unpredictable. And I think it really helped that it threw up some really emotional stories and interesting storylines as well. I love being reminded that racing is racing, and it's not always just ushering the Aidan O'Briens and the John Gosdens of this world into the winner's enclosure. But I appreciate not everyone feels that way. Matt, some of the results did make sense. I mean, we had Trawlerman, who justified his odds, Mission Central, who of course won the first two-year-old condition stakes, and Kalpana, who bounced back from her arc run, and even Calandagana, a lot of people would have found him, as well as, I know Crown of Oaks was well backed in the Balmoral as well. So it wasn't a total crazy fest. What did you make of some of the performances? Who did you sort of mainly take out of the event?
Oh, it has to be Calandagan for me. He's just a completely changed individual in the space from 3 to 4. I remember this time last year, exactly that, when he was narrowly beaten in the Champions Stakes. And even earlier this campaign in the Coronation Cup, we were saying, oh, does Calandagan really want it? Is he a bit of a soft horse? And then all of a sudden, within the space of the 3 runs, he's completely transformed. And it's probably rightly going to be plaudited as the best middle distance horse in the world. I think the main thing was, obviously, yes, there was the shocks and they were brilliant. But in the main race itself, the biggest race, we wanted to crown the best horse in Europe and possibly in the world over middle distances. It truly delivered. And Calandagan was just absolutely awesome. He seemed to be the best horse in the world. I wouldn't have thought he'd be an ombudsman as easily as he did, which is just magnificent. And, you know, lots been said about Francis Graffard and the Aga Khan studs already, but they're probably the best sort of team of trainers and owners in over middle distances, especially as well. So it was really, really good that the Champion Stakes properly delivered as the end of season, you know, the end of season decisive bout in a way. And, you know, Trawlerman was fantastic as well. But for me, it was all about Calandagan.
On that subject about Graffard, so he's obviously won the Arc and the Champion Stakes, you know, amazing. Had a great season anyway. And, you know, it really feels like he's the sort of surging force in European flat racing. But you go back to Royal Ascot. He came over with, you know, a select team of 5, but really strong looking. Like, I mean, they were, I think 4 of them were quite strongly fancied. And didn't win anything, and you know, he had that sort of quite brave interview that he gave on telly after the Coronation Stakes when Zaragana got beat, talking about how, you know, it's hard to come here, it's high quality racing, really competitive, and he, you know, he was sort of slightly left with his tail between his legs, and just a complete change in the atmosphere from then to now. And I think that's sort of symbolic. You sort of think that because these fixtures are taking place at the same race course, Royal Ascot and Champions Day, the form should carry over. You know, the horses that win in June should also be winning in October. And they're just two different beasts. It doesn't seem to work that way. You look at Lezat and Field of Gold, you know, who looked absolute rockets back in the summer. You know, then they've got turned over at the weekend. And if you placed your total faith in their seemingly dominant ability, you've done your money.
Yeah, it's just fascinating, isn't it? I was doing the Antipost Angles column in today's paper covering Nick Watts, and I found it so difficult because we are at that stage in the season where there aren't loads of Antipost markets for next year. But I guess it gives us a chance to take stock, and I think the sprinting division on its own, we know how remarkable that's been this season. You know, you've had no half measures winning the July Cup at a massive price, several other big shocks. The only one who's really been able to stamp her authority on the division to some extent is Asfora, and hopefully we'll see her come back next year. Don't know about, this is the thing, isn't it? We don't know about plans for some of the entire horses, whether they're going to come back, the likes of Field of Gold, Rosalian in the mile division. And Trawlerman, I mean, 6-1 for the Gold Cup, that is the opposite of my kind of bet. But I guess with the weakness in the staying division as well, you could argue that that's a bit of value. What do we think of these divisions, Matt?
I just thought your next sentence in that article about the anti-post tipping was right about Trawlerman. I mean, he obviously does look pretty tempting at that price, but he'd be 8 next year. You know, as a jumps fan, I can think of a lot better uses for the potential stake money between now and then.
Yeah, I just hope as many horses as possible come back and remain in training. We're very lucky that Calandagan is going to be there. And I think that's probably one of the real boons of Champions Day is the fact that geldings get to run in the Champions Stakes for me, because they can't run in the Arc, so you know they're going to be prepared for it. And I also think it's not going to ruin Ombudsman's stud career. You know, he's a multiple Group 1 winner, an extraordinary horse, ran a great race. It's the old cliche, isn't it? Lost nothing in defeat there. But I think, you know, if he can't beat a gelding, then in theory that will strengthen our breeding pool, which is exactly what we need at the minute. But anyway, Matt, I return to you. Sprinting division, staying division, miling division. I mean, who are the horses you want to be with going forward?
Ooh, it's a great question. Obviously, staying-wise, you hope that sort of Scandinavia is the next one out of the O'Brien ranks to take on Trawlham. And again, we just don't know really. Sometimes Aidan will drop his St. Ledger winners back down to a mile and a half, but Scandinavia strikes me as a you know, he's a good World Cup winner, so he's a proper stayer. Sprinting wise, you know, especially the six furlong division, let's not be around the bush. It's been rubbish this year in terms of quality.
It's been rubbish in terms of
great in narrative.
I love it. Yeah, because if you have a flyer and want a big price, you're in with a chance, and it's a really compelling puzzle.
Absolutely so. But I always have my doubts about the strength of Wise Approach's Middle Park win as well. So you're left next year thinking, you know, there's going to be 3-year-old sprinters coming through, much of the same bit. It's the mile division which sort of bewildered me the most. I'm sure everyone else, because given 3 months ago, this time, we were thinking, oh, it's Field of Gold. He's just going to become Rattle the Star Miler, take on the older horses, breeze them aside. You know, people were saying he was the best since Frankel, which was, I wrote a column earlier in the year, said it was actually ludicrous because he's not even in Baid's sort of shadow in a way. He's not even on the tails of what Baid did. So all of a sudden you've got Field of Gold who, you know, yes, he was coming back from a comeback and an injury layoff at the weekend, but he just looked.
You think we'll see him again? Because Jugmont often are quite sporting.
I think if you see him again, you'd want to be seeing him over a mile and a quarter, because he just looked a bit one-paced and a bit sort of one-dimensional for me over the mile. It'd be nice to see him again, because obviously Rosalian's not most likely not going to be here next year. So that's complete. The mile division is completely open, and it was at the start of the year, especially the older division was completely open as well. So it leaves a lot of what ifs. I'd like to see Field of Gold. I'm a racing fan. I'm not one that would want to rush horses off to stud as quick as possible. But if you said to me at the start of this, after the Irish Guineas, we'd be sitting here thinking, oh, he's what do we do with him? Is he actually as good as we thought he was going to be? You'd be laughing your head off, really.
Yeah, and people were criticising that form beforehand, weren't they, saying that he didn't really beat much. But he looks so explosive in those two victories at the Curra and Ascot. It's just interesting to know. I mean, the lack of match practice was blamed on Saturday. Chris, you were going to say?
Yeah, just on behalf of Rosalian, Matt's chasing him off to stud. And maybe that is what will happen. But I strongly feel if they were to bring him back next year, they could be rewarded with quite a good campaign. I mean, you know, to me, he looks like the physical type who, with another year on his back, can be better again. You know, he's got, when he opens up, he's got a really big stride on him. And I just, I didn't start the year with any particular feeling for him. But as things have gone on and he keeps on sort of hitting the bar and not quite finding the back of the onion bag, I've sort of, you know, ended up really warming to him. And maybe that's been his downfall. I've been a terrible Jonah for some good horses over the years. But I can't help feeling that, you know, if the draw had been kinder on a couple of occasions or one or two things had just worked out, he'd have won at least one Group One this year. If he comes back next year, there's definitely races to be won with him. And I think he can prove himself a good horse. Whereas if he goes to stud now, you know, it's been a bit of a damp squib this final campaign. And it doesn't have to end that way. He can rebuild his reputation. I still believe in the horse.
Okay, Chris is retaining belief. All those horses we've just mentioned, and we still might not have spoken about the best horse in the world who won very early on in Saturday morning, Kaiying Rising. What a fascinating build-up that was to the Everest. There was people who were saying this horse can never be beaten beforehand. And then he had his slightly dodgy trial, which left people concerned. Then David Hay's phone got hacked and there was the big drift on Betfair. People thought the horse was out of the race. And in the end, he just did what Kaiying Rising does. Such a straightforward horse and an exceptional sprinter. I thought this was just magnificent for the sport, even if you're not a big follower of international racing. I think we can all appreciate just a super speedy, dominant horse, and that's exactly what he is. How sporting of them to send him to Australia. I spoke to David Hayes quite a while ago now about him, and he was never particularly keen on Royal Ascot. I think the placing of the races and also the prize money is just not tempting enough, but I would certainly love to see him come over. Matt, you suggested this as a talking point to talk about as well. So why were you so taken by it?
It's just simply because he's an absolute speedball. He's as a sprinter, he's a he's a freak of nature, really. And it sort of does link to, you know, what we were talking about, the dearth in quality of the sprinting division over here is completely different on the other side of the world. I mean, it sounds, you said, Royal Ascot's a bit in the air for him. Even if the track didn't suit him or whatnot, I think he'd still win doing handstands, to be honest with you, given the lack of quality our six furlong sprinting division has, especially. It's just great. You know, they did everything right for the Everest. I was never a big fan of it when they introduced these new group ones, you know, obviously the world's richest race, into the world. I'm more sort of a sucker for change sometimes. But it's, you know, seeing the crowds over there and attracting one of the very best horses out of Hong Kong, which we don't rarely get to see that much often. I was trying to think back to the ones we've had over in Britain. Obviously, you know, King Stands winner a fair few years ago now. And
Little Bridge.
Yeah, that was it. And we had a
friend came over as well, didn't he?
Exactly that. Yeah, we never get the luxury of seeing those Hong Kong horses compete on the real global international stage as much as we do the Japanese horses or the French horses or even the Australian horses, obviously, with us for us. So it was great they went over there, took it on away from their unnatural environment and proved that they are the best sprinter in the world. It's easily lay claims to that now.
Definitely. Chris, just before we move on, I don't know if you saw the scenes in Australia on Saturday morning. I thought the crowd and the sheer enthusiasm, the mood behind the day, the attendance was excellent. I just thought, gosh, they're doing something right over there, aren't they?
And you get a flavour of that as well anytime you watch racing from Hong Kong. It can make you jealous for sure. Although, you know, let's not beat ourselves up too much. You know, the Champions Day crowd was up 8%, I think, on Saturday. And there's a general trend this year for the major flat racing festivals that things are sort of recovering, you know, rather than expanding. And we're getting back some of the spectators that we lost around COVID time and afterwards. So, I mean, that's great to see because, you know, these are still tough times economically and it means something when people place their faith in racing as a day's entertainment.
It certainly does. Well, one of the most entertaining spectacles in our sport is the Cheltenham Festival. And there was some news this week regarding changes to the meeting. Stay tuned and we'll talk about those next. Welcome back to the Front Page. Now, a double whammy of Cheltenham news. First one is that the Mayor's Hurdle has been moved from its usual Tuesday slot. Now it's going to be run on Thursday. The plate now shifts to Tuesday. And the second piece of news, which was an exclusive yesterday, last night, and in today's paper, is that there's consultation ongoing by Cheltenham to potentially move the festival from Tuesday to Friday to Wednesday to Saturday. This comes hot on the heels, not quite hot on the heels, but after consultations of a potential five-day festival a couple of years ago. So Cheltenham clearly looking, with its new chief executive, Guy Lavender, about making some changes. Let's start with the Mayor's Hurdle first off. Matt, I'll come to you first. Obviously, one of the main things for me is it usually forms part of that Willie Mullins four-timer on day one. Punters aren't really going to be able to get stuck in the same way now, and maybe it'll impact some of those decisions regarding Lossiemouth, you know, Champion Hurdle on the Tuesday or Mayor's Hurdle on the Thursday now. What do you make of it? Do you think it was needed?
Needed, definitely not. And I am against it in a way. What I did love about the opening day of the Cheltenham Festival, and it was branded as Champion Day, is you were hit smack in the face with four brilliant grade ones. Admittedly, see, there's debate whether the Mayor's Hurdle should even be at the Cheltenham Festival, but while that's still there, it was in a slot where you had your Supreme started off with an absolute bang, then you had your best two novice chasers in the Arkle, then the Mayor's, and then the Champion Hurdle. It was non-stop, and what I really loved, sort of sucking you into the festival itself. I think it was not needed. I can understand why they've done it to sort of strengthen the Thursday card and give an even spread of grade ones throughout the 4 days. But it also has changed the complexity of the race probably quite a lot. You think of the new course, less jumping, more test of stamina. You know, you're going to get a completely different mare going for that race now? And if we had a good mare going for the stays, would they then transfer to the mare's hurdle and whatnot? And the plate changes the dynamics in its own way as well. Back on,
will it, will it encourage more mares to go for the champion, do you think? Because the, if they've got the speed that they would have had for the old mares, they'll now want to be looking for a slightly easier test?
I don't think so, because I think they'd still view the mares as significantly easier to take on than the champion hurdle and would rather have a go at trying to stay just that little bit extra further than they would do against the likes of, well, State Man really is the big one. So I was just not for it. And, you know, I know they've also changed the timings of the Ryanair chase and the stayers hurdle around as well. So it looks like the Ryanair is almost the feature of the Thursday now, which I'm not too in agreement with, because it's always been stayers hurdle day for me, that one. Yeah, it's just one of them. It's changed the complexity. I'm all for having a bit of, you know, a bit of a go at change, but it just makes the day, it makes the opening day a bit more harder as well on the punting perspective now, given we've got the plate and the, what was the Boodles, the Fred Winter juvenile hurdle as well. So yeah, not for me. I liked how we used to be slap bang in the face with four really good grade ones to get the meeting underway. It's just sort of lost that edge a little bit now.
Yeah, Tuesday is my favourite day, and I'm in agreement. It's funny, isn't it? On this show especially, we're often talking about how we want to see innovation. We want people to try new things, and then the minute they do, we all go, actually, I like the way it was. Very typical, Chris.
Change is bad, Maddie. Change is always
Yeah, tough. Well, it's been a very divisive race. Myself and Matt, not too keen on the move, but I can understand why they've done it. What do you think?
It's interesting what Matt says. It's quite a bookie friendly move, and I don't mean a racecourse bookie. You're talking about the high street bookies. There's been a couple of times when they were saved from having to pay out really significant sums of money because
you think this is a genuine driving force behind it.
I didn't say that, but I mean, conceivably, if you were a high street bookmaker talking to Cheltenham about changes that you might like to see, getting rid of one of those pesky grade ones and replacing it with a really difficult handicap is maybe something that would come to your mind. I mean, I've always found personally that the Thursday is the most difficult betting day at the festival since it's been 4 days. I mean, like, it's really hard. The two feature races are fairly tricky themselves, unless you've got sort of standout in the stairs hurdle. And then the handicaps are just, you know, crazy stuff. Whereas, you know, day one, you can build some confidence, you know, you can pick a few winners. You can maybe even put them together in the doubles or trebles if you're feeling very ambitious and extra skilled. And I always thought that bookies were comfortable with that, because then you've got the next 3 days where lots of people invariably give the money back if they made any on the Tuesday. But perhaps, you know, the feeling was, listen, we're a little bit exposed to sort of ACCA disaster. You know, it would be great if we could get one of those really difficult handicaps onto Tuesday's card. If that's not the reasoning, I'm struggling to see a really strong case for making those moves that they have. And you know, given that there are issues, aren't there, with the jumps program, with dilution at the Cheltenham Festival, it would be good to see moves made that would make some of those races more competitive, but that's not what these are. And so I'm left with the feeling that it's slightly fiddling at the margins.
Yeah, I totally agree. Let's move on to the second Cheltenham talking point, which is moving the meeting from Tuesday to Friday to Wednesday to Saturday. Now, again, I don't want to be too negative, because we like to encourage people to innovate and try new things. And if they fail, then they fail. But again, I'm really against this. And I think maybe this is a slightly journalism perspective, but I think it shows a lack of confidence in what they're doing. Is actually, we need to make all these changes because the way that things are is not good enough. And I sort of think they're not good enough from a race programming point of view, from a horse population view. We know that. But in terms of moving it to a Saturday, I just think it shows that, you know, it's going to potentially be at risk from other sports now. It's going to be less exclusive, if you like, because it's going to be a weekend. I know that opens up more opportunities for more racegoers to go, but I think a lot's made of that, when in actual fact, most people, if they want to go to an event like Cheltenham, they can book the day off work and go and make the effort, and it's a special thing to do.
You get families on a Saturday. I think that's the big difference. And I can see the appeal of that. You know, you get people with kids coming along who just wouldn't be able to make it during the week.
Yeah, that's a fair point. But I just, for me, I think there's just, it would be sad, I think, if it moved to a Saturday. And I also wonder about the Midlands Grand National. You know, every big race deserves its day. And what knock-on effect is that going to have to Uttoxeter if there's now the Gold Cup on a Saturday? I like that we have a space of our own for the Cheltenham Festival. It deserves that. And I think if we move it onto a Saturday, there'll be too much competition with other sports. There'll be too much else going on. And it sort of loses that special, unique factor to me. But I can see the logic. I mean, they're obviously trying to make more money. And essentially, that's got to be a key consideration for Cheltenham. I just wish they showed a bit more. You know, if you want to make Cheltenham better, get rid of a couple of races. But that wouldn't help them very much, I don't think, in the short term.
I mean, if you could direct the quality of the action on the track back to where it was sort of 10 or 15 years ago, then I think you'd be doing a terrific thing. You know, that was always the main driver for creating the buzz and the excitement around the festival. Yeah. And that's what drove up crowds. You know, that sense that this was, people were having a really good time there. And so this was a fun place to be. And so it's a great mistake to neglect that as a factor. You know, that's at the heart of everything. I don't mind the idea of going to a Saturday. People talk about, you know, the Gold Cup might get lost if competing with the final day of the Six Nations rugby, which is what that Saturday usually is. I would absolutely back the Gold Cup as a sporting draw.
It doesn't need it though, does it? It's an obstacle that you're putting in the way that when it doesn't need to be there.
You're choosing that extra. They clearly feel that in light of the crowd numbers that they've lost in the last couple of years, they need to do everything they can to make the meeting accessible to large numbers of people. And so, yeah, I could see the attraction of moving it to Wednesday to Saturday. The problem is, it seems that if they do that, they wouldn't actually have the Gold Cup on the Saturday. They'd have it on the Friday, because they would imagine that you can take a big crowd for granted on the Saturday. And then what you need is some strong races on their previous days to ensure that those days also get big numbers. What I hear is that the Gold Cup would likely stay on the Friday. And that makes me slightly uneasy. I mean, again, you know, call me a terrible old traditionalist, but I do feel like the festival should end on a high. And I don't quite know what the atmosphere would be on that Saturday if you've already run the Gold Cup and your feature race is, you know, something like the Ryanair.
That is just, yeah, that's the main bit for me, is the Gold Cup. The thing the Cheltenham Festival does really well at the moment is we build up to that massive crescendo of the big race, the defining race of the festival. No matter what, no matter how good the champion hurdle is, the champion chase, the stayers, the Ryanair, it's all about the Gold Cup in terms of building up to that race. It's the pinnacle of the very best of jumps racing. So moving, then having a day after that and the Gold Cup on the Friday, it's sort of after the Lord Mayor's show anyway. And it was like,
it'd be dreadful.
We've got this now. It takes the flow of it completely down. And my concern,
I'd argue that flow's struggling anyway with, you know, you've got that mare's chase, which is always a bit of a damp squib, and it kind of goes out with a bit of a on the Friday bar in the Gold Cup, I think.
Indeed, afterwards
anyway.
Definitely so. And I know Chris talked about the loon, so we don't need to sort of fear the Six Nations in a way. I think I can understand that. What I fear the most is you're also going to be competing with Premier League football and Football League football on that day. And I spoke to a couple of, you know, we had a few chats last night with a couple of mates, and they went, what they like about the Cheltenham Festival is during the week, they can fully focus on Cheltenham. But if it's a Saturday, they go watch their football team. And I dare say they're one of a fair few people, men, women, anyone, because obviously football's a hugely popular sport. Many people have a season tickets, you know. Travel would probably be a bit more of a nightmare for people on the Saturdays if they're coming from big cities like Birmingham, Manchester, even Bristol. There's going to be so many people going here, there.
Make it more expensive as well.
Exactly that as well. We've seen that trend concerningly. That's one of the main gripes for Cheltenham for me, and they need to try and do whatever they can with rail companies and stuff to make discounts for travel to Cheltenham and stuff. And then I think we'll see a better upturn. But yeah, so I think, you know, the running order in terms of the days, you know, it has to be the Gold Cup's last. That's the main thing. I'm not as, you know, for or against as Wednesday to Saturdays as I'm not on one real side a lot. I'd love it to stay the same as it is, but it has to be ended on the Gold Cup day, the Cheltenham Festival. It has to be.
Okay, so I'm a thumbs down for the Mayor's Hurdle move and a big thumbs down for the potential shift to including Saturday. Sounds like you two, Chris, you're being slightly more diplomatic than me and Matt.
I'm not trying to be diplomatic. I can see an upside to at least the move to Saturday. It depends how you play. Liam Watershed's piece in today's Racing Post was interesting, where he pointed out that ITV have just done a new four-year deal to cover horse racing. And they're now faced with the distinct possibility, if this change takes place, of having to put one day of the Cheltenham Festival on ITV4 rather than the main ITV channel, because that's where they'll be showing the rugby if the racing does move to that Saturday. And so that would mean that, you know, what they've just paid for is actually less valuable to them in the future than they were expecting. And, you know, do we want to put our broadcast partners' nose out of joints so soon after a bit of good news like that? Possibly not.
Indeed. And I think it's fair to say as well, just, you know, I'm not all for change, but I'm all for exploring change in a way. Yep. Guy Lavender, I think if you applaud it, he's come in, as you do with any new CEO, he's come in and sort of looked at where he wants to go and change, but also it's key that the days of the change, it's not set in plan that it's happening. The feelers are just being put out there. That's all it is. And I think that's the right way of going about it as well, to get the atmosphere from it. I mean, it doesn't have to be volatile, but if people disagree with it, you know, and strongly disagree with it in a professional way, then we can go, right, well, we're not doing that. We can see the feeling within the sport. We'll leave it. We'll look for other changes. So it's just about sort of finding where the changes can come. And one time, it might not be this one. I wouldn't want it to be this one. It will land as a positive one along the way.
You are so right.
Just to wrap up this, I mean, the bottom line for me is that if people want to be radical in horse racing in a way that's going to revive jump racing and the Cheltenham Festival in particular, the thing to look at is limiting the power of any one individual trainer or racing yard, because that's the change over the last 20 or 25 years, which to me has undermined the competitiveness that we're seeing on the track. The fact that the super trainers have got so big, you know, they have the top however many horses in each division in the yard. And so they, you know, if they spread out their own horses, we don't ever get to find out, you know, who's best. It used to be the top seven or eight horses for each division would be all in different yards. And so you could rely on them showing up on the big day. And that's not how it is anymore. And it has a very undermining effect.
It does. I'd just add as my final word, if they want to make a radical change, kill some of those races. That's the number one thing that they could do, but I don't think they're going to do it anytime soon. That was a big talking point, wasn't it, for October, the start of the jump season. We'll see how that plays out over the next couple of weeks. Let us know on both this and Champions Day and the next talking point, actually, your thoughts in the comments that start some discussion, and hopefully Guy Lavender can use that to make some decisions. Now, on to our final talking point of the show, and that is betting shop closures. Fred Dunn warning that all Betfred shops on the high street may close yesterday. There's 7,500 jobs at risk potentially there for that one firm. This comes straight after Evoke, the company who own William Hill, said they were preparing to close a tenth of their shops if the proposed changes to betting tax are implemented. And Flutter, Paddy Power as well, saying that they're going to close 47 shops in the UK and Ireland nevertheless. Now, it's clearly there's a bit of positioning involved here with the budget upcoming next month, but nevertheless, the sort of the betting landscape is changing. We're online more than ever now, but this is still worrying news for a hugely important industry that you know, this amount of job losses is going to make a difference and going to be damaging for racing. Chris, has it surprised you quite the numbers that we're seeing regarding these closures?
Well, when Fred Doan says that, you know, potentially his entire estate might be gone, that's really arresting, I think, for anybody. You would very much like to hope that whatever happens, that's not going to happen. I think it's totally natural that bookmakers are going to be coming out and spelling out the potential consequences of a tax rise, you know, an additional drain on the profitability of their business. They still think that there's a chance to persuade the Chancellor before the budget against doing something like hiking taxes on them. And so it's perfectly natural for them to spell out potential consequences. And it's something that, you know, racing has to take very seriously. I mean, my first thought is obviously, you know, for anybody working in those shops or in any of the allied businesses who might lose their jobs as a consequence of these closures, you know, you really have to feel for them. This is not the right economy to be looking for work in. But don't underestimate the potential impact on horse racing of betting shop closures, because although there has been this sort of long-term shift in business towards online, it's a gradual thing. And we still have more than 6,000 betting shops in Britain. Bookmakers are not charities. They're not keeping those shops open, you know, just to, for the sake of employing some people and pleasing the landlord. They're viable businesses as things are now. And they are generating cash for racing, interest in racing. I think the estimate, depending on which firm you speak to, is that something like half of the levy comes from shops rather than anywhere else, and perhaps more than half of media rights payments. So, you know, we can't be glib about this. We can't just say, oh, betting shops have been in long-term decline. They have been a really fruitful source of money for horse racing and, as I say, interest as well, because when you get those major meetings that punters can't necessarily get to, Cheltenham Ascot, Derby Grand National, you know, the betting shop is still a real centre of interest at those times. And yes, it did used to be different when I was getting into racing. You know, there was a sort of social aspect to being in the bookies, and you could be sure that if you wandered in there, you know, when there was racing on, there would be someone else who was also interested in the racing you could chat to about it. And that is no longer the case. But they're still, you know, really important to the sport. And, you know, any loss of shops is a loss for racing.
Definitely. Matt, as I say, there are, you know, intrinsic links to this imposing betting tax, the harmonisation of tax, the racing tax, as it's been called. We've still got a bit of time before the budget comes out. We had the representatives in Parliament not so long ago making their stand, the racing strike, of course. Do you think that we've got a chance of turning this around? Do you think it's a foregone conclusion?
You're right. We've still got a month and a bit, like a month and a couple of days to go until the budget, which feels unusually late for me for this time of year, as in late November. We're getting to squeaky bum time now. This is what the bookmakers speaking out, you know, it's sort of been like a chain reaction in a way. We're getting to that squeaky bum time where people are now unifying on sort of one final push towards the Treasury to say, this is why you shouldn't raise taxes as much as or harmonise as well, and then raise it to an even starker level. I can be a sceptic in the thing. I think the tax rises probably will be proposed in the budget. I'm at that point. Racing's done a good job in unified and sort of raising its concerns to about the racing tax. You know, and I'm not the biggest fan of it myself, but sometimes in life things happen, and it just feels like we might just have underestimated our position and actually how powerful the sport is compared to the government. Which, you know, there's plenty of things going on in the country that'll also be involved in the budget. So, yeah, it's squeaky bum time. Because I echo what Chris said completely. It'd be a crying shame if so many high street bookmaker shops were to be lost, because they are underestimated how powerful they are within the sport and, as it said, in the levy.
Yeah, such an integral role that they play. That's all we do have time for on today's show, because it's been so busy with the Champions Day review and talking about those Cheltenham changes. If you can see me smiling, it's because I'm in an office and several racing post faces are coming in and waving at me because they're about to record the big jump off. So make sure to stay tuned to all the Racing Post channels. Our great special edition of the Big Jump Off out today, and there's a preview to go with that. So stay tuned, and we will make way for the likes of Tom Siegel, Paul Keighley, and Pat Cooney. As I say, make sure to leave your thoughts on some of the sport's big issues in the comments, and we'll be back again in a week's time. Thanks for joining us.